Dr. Albert Tekon on the topic of aquaculture feeds, addressing the long-term sustainability of the sector. Dr. Albert Tekon earned his BSc in 1973 in botany and zoology from Westfield College, University of London, England, and his PhD in 1978 in aquaculture nutrition from University College of Cardiff in Wales. Dr. Tekon has over 30 years of experiences in aquaculture nutrition and feed development activities, including 14 years with the FAO within national, regional, and inter-regional aquaculture development projects. Dr. Tekon is an aquaculture consultant based in San Diego and is the technical director of Aquatic Farm Limited in Kaneohe, Hawaii, the United States of America. May the distinguished participant welcome Dr. Albert Tekon.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's my pleasure to be here with you. I'm going to present a paper based on the inputs received from a whole series of people that we will see later on in front. And so this paper represents a consensus of the group concerning aquaculture feeds addressing the long-term sustainability of the sector. The rapid growth of the aquaculture sector has been due in part to the availability and the supply of inputs in terms of feed. For most fish and crustacean farmers, feed is the largest operating cost. And the important thing for the future is how aquaculture can keep growing in the future, can maintain its growth rate of 8.4% per year. If we look at global aquaculture production, we have 68 million metric tons of product. Of this, about 46% are fish and crustacean species that we have to feed. And for the purposes of this paper, feed is either a compound industrial feed, a farm-made feed, or the use of fresh food organisms. If we look at the growth of fish and crustacean production, which we feed, we have a sector that's growing very rapidly, on average 10.7% per year since 1980. And the important thing here is that 75% of production are freshwater fish. Countries like China are big, a lot of people live inland, and we have to feed them. But so it's very much a freshwater production system at the moment. And if we compare agriculture with aquaculture, I've just put the top 8 farm, fish, and crustacean species and compared it with the top 8 livestock species that we grow. And you can see that the number one species are species like grass carp, common carp, tilapia, katla, and then shrimp. Okay, but you can see that these 8 species alone represent about 58% of production of fed species. And the sector, again, growing very well. If you look at the total production of compound feed, the estimate at the moment is 29 million tons of feed. The largest producer are fed carps, shrimp, tilapia, catfish, and so on. Okay. Again, it's quite difficult collecting this information, and this information is really from the feed companies themselves. But you can see again that the largest producer at the moment is for the production of carps, and this is China. If you look at the production of feeds since 1995, again, the problem is we have a sector that's growing very fast, but it can only continue growing in this way in the future if it has ingredients that can keep pace with that growth rate. Okay? So we have to find ingredients, and every year we have to find more, and we have to compete more with other users. If you look at the top 10 producers of feed in the world, again, China stands out alone, producing between 13 and 15 million metric tons of feed. Number two, again, these results are based on the responses we got from a feed survey that we sent to all the countries around the world. But again, the top producers are China, Vietnam, Thailand, Norway, Indonesia, Chile, the USA, Japan, Philippines, and Taiwan. For some countries, we have up-to-date information. For other countries, it's hard to obtain sometimes. But the important point is China. It's big, it's hungry, and it has to feed its people, and it has to feed its livestock. And it has effect on all of us in this room. The important thing to know is that we say, okay, aquaculture maybe produces between 24 and 29 million tons of feed. This is only 4% of global animal feed production, the production of pigs, of poultry, and other species. And we all have to compete for the same resources, for the same ingredients. One of the problems with our study is the lack of information that exists on the total global production of farm-made feeds. Again, the last study that we did showed that production was between 18 and 30 million metric tons in 2006. And also there's scant information on the use of low-value fish as a direct feed. The latest data that we had from China was using between 6 and 8 million metric tons of low-value fish just in China. Again, this is mainly feeding the marine finfish industry. It doesn't matter what the species that we're farming and we're feeding, they're all the same as all humans. We require 40 essential nutrients. And the way we supply this is depends on the country, depends on the resources available. We have at the top aquatic animal protein meals and lipids. These are fish meals, fish oils. We have the oilseed meals and pulses, the soybean meals, the canolas and unlike. We have the byproducts that come from terrestrial sector, the poultry byproduct meal, the meats and bone meals, the poultry oils. We have the cereal byproducts coming from the cereal industry, the wheat glutens, the corn glutens, the whole variety of products. And we have what we call microbial proteins. These are bacteria, yeast, and algae. And in every country, this cycle is a bit different, but the aim is we have to supply those 40 nutrients to the fish or the shrimp that we're growing in an economical way. And so one of the parts of our report was looking at current feed ingredient usage and constraints. And obviously, it's been mentioned already this morning, the continued use of fish meal and fish oil is a major protein and lipid source. And if you look at some species, I've lost my mouse, okay. You have species like eel that have an average fish meal content of between 55 and 65% and a fish oil content of 3 to 18. Marine fish species, salmonids, and shrimp, and freshwater prawns. It's still the number one animal protein that's available in the marketplace to most aquaculture producers. The problem with the world is fish meal is finite. Every year the production of fish meal available in the marketplace is actually going down. These are the estimates of Fish Oil and Meal World, and they estimate that for 2010 we've got about 4.5 million metric tons. As an ingredient, there's nothing better. It's beautiful. But the problem is we have an industry that's growing, and it wants to keep growing. So what's happened is that the industry has been using less of it to extend it. So this is the production of fish meal, and this is the production of fish oil. Again, the values, the estimates for 2010 are 810,000 tons. From the results of our survey, we estimate at the moment that the aquaculture sector is consuming 4.6 million tons of fish meal and fish oil. And these are the levels of the different meals. However, in every country, there's large variation. Depends on whether you're growing a fry feed or a grow-out feed. And it's dependent on availability and cost and economics. And this slide shows you the use of fish meal by the different major groups. You can see that species like shrimp are currently the major consumers of fish meal, followed by marine fish species, salmonids, carps. And in terms of fish oil, the largest producer is salmon, followed by other species. In terms of the use of these products for the sector, we think that basically the use of fish meal by the aquaculture sector is expected to decrease in the long term. from a high of 4.2 million tons in 2005 to 3.8 million tons in 2007 to analysis that I've done for the future down to 3.7 million tons by 2020. The reason for this is basically that every year more and more of the fish that we process into fish meal goes for direct human consumption, and also because of increasing fish meal prices that I will show, and also because of the availability in the marketplace of less expensive fish meal replacers. And so this slide is from IFO, the International Fish Meal and Fish Oil Organization. And really this slide is just saying that every year more and more of the fish that they process is going to direct human consumption. And if you look at this slide shows you the 5-year annual average prices for fish meal and fish oil. And you can see how every year the prices are going up rather than going down. And the problem for the feed manufacturer and the farmer is that the prices of our commodities aren't necessarily going up. So somehow we have to reduce our production costs to remain competitive. At the moment, the price of fish meal is about $1,500 a ton. And so this slide basically shows how every year since 1995, the level of fish meal used in diets for carps, for tilapia, for catfishes and miscellaneous freshwater fishes, every year we're using less as a percent of the diet. But again, mainly because feed companies are trying to find alternative sources because of availability. If you look at salmon and trout, the more carnivorous species, again, levels are decreasing year by year. And these are other species, even species like milkfish, levels before of 15% now are down to 5%, and for shrimp. And again, shrimp, the average level is about 20% of the diet is fish meal. But because we produce, you know, a lot of shrimp, in terms of total usage, shrimp is consuming more fish meal than any other sector. And so in terms of fish oil, there will continue to be a strong demand for fish oil in aquaculture diets, because production volumes are static or falling, the levels used in feeds are also decreasing. And also there's a growing demand for using fish oil, and especially the omega-3 fatty acids, for direct human consumption. And, you know, you have many groups. These are groups that basically show the demand for refined fish oils. These are mainly sources of omega-3 fatty acids, of EPA and DHA, for direct human consumption. And so the use of fish oil in the future, the reduction of fish oil availability combined with the rapid growth of the aquaculture sector will mean that the inclusion levels we use will decrease. This will not necessarily be deleterious to the fish or shrimp, but it might affect the level of EPA in the final product that we give to the consumer. Alternatives to fish oil, we have a whole variety of vegetable oils, preferably those high in omega-3 like soy, canola, palm, and also poultry oil. And also we have oil that's coming on stream from the processing of aquaculture products, like byproducts from salmon, for example. And also we have a whole variety of alternative lipid sources that are coming on stream. These are mainly single-cell proteins like algae, yeast, and bacteria, with a high HUFA content, high content of EPA and DHA. At the moment, they're quite expensive, but as production increases, prices will decrease as well. And this is just showing a few companies that are already producing single-cell proteins with really high levels of DHA or EPA. And all these are coming on stream. All these are going mainly for direct human consumption at the moment. But the dream of all of us is that the prices of some of these commodities will fall. So this is talking about fish meals and fish oils. But also what we found is an increased use of terrestrial animal protein meals and oils. And these are products that's coming from the production of poultry, of pigs, of the meats that we produce. And the major products here are things like poultry byproduct meal, feather meal, blood meal, meat and bone meal, and the lipids. And again, these are the results that came back from the surveys. The levels of some of these products used in a variety of feeds is quite considerable and quite important. And if I could just give one example, this is the responses just for salmon. But in our survey, we did tilapia, carps, catfish, shrimp, a whole variety of species. But this just shows you that depending on the country, Australia, Canada, Chile, Norway, the UK, these are the levels of fish meal and different byproducts that they are using. And you can see that for Australia, Canada, and Chile, the use of these animal byproduct meals is quite high. Again, this is because they're allowed to use them in other countries, such as the UK or within the EU. The use is prohibited. And because of that, they have to use higher levels of fish meal. But again, so every country is different, every region is different, depending on where you're selling your product. If you think with fish meal, we got maybe 5 million tons. In fish oil, we've just got under 1 million tons. In terms of animal byproducts, we've got at least 13 million metric tons of animal proteins and at least 10 million metric tons of lipids. The use currently used is still quite small. Only about 1% of total feeds contain these products, between 150 and 300,000 tons. And so clearly there's room, considerable room for improvement and growth in this sector. But the important thing is that we have a sector, this is a graph showing the production of meat globally. You know, we have a sector growing 10% per year, so we must also find ingredients that can grow, whose production can grow with the sector as well. In terms of plant proteins, I put here the main finding, the continued and increased use of plant protein meals and oils as dietary nutrient sources. Again, we have a whole variety of products, the main one being soybean meal, but also we have wheat gluten, corn gluten, rapeseed, canola, a whole variety of products depending on the country and what's available in the marketplace. And we also have a whole variety of plant oils like canola, soybean, and palm oil. These plant proteins and oils represent the major source of dietary protein and lipid in most of the lower trophic level species that we're culturing, like tilapia, carp, and catfish. And they represent the second largest source of dietary protein and lipid after fish meal and fish oil within shrimp feeds and the higher trophic level marine species. These are, again, part of the surveys. We have lots of information in the paper that you will have, but this is the level, the global average. Again, every country will have their own levels and quite large variation. But for tilapia, for example, we have soybean levels ranging from 20% to 60%. Corn gluten meal, 5 to 10. Canola, between 20 and 40%. Every country is different. The important message to take home is that all these ingredients supply nutrients. And at the end of the day, what the fish and shrimp require, or catfish, are nutrients. And as a nutritionist, our job is to make that cocktail and supply it to the fish. Okay, so these are the levels. Again, there's lots of information here. To put everything in context, global production of oilseeds was about 427 million metric tons. And soybean alone is 230 million tons of product. It's the commonest source of plant protein used in feeds, and the average level is between 15 and 30%, and with a mean of 25% for most herbivorous and omnivorous fish species. Just in China alone, they import about 6 million tons of soybean, mainly for the aquaculture sector. Again, China is big and it's hungry, and it has to import these ingredients. Again, the important take-home message is the total global production of these oilseed products. This is the production of oilseeds, soybeans, rapeseeds, cottonseed, groundnuts. Every year, production is increasing. Every year, we add 80 million people to this planet. Every year, we have to feed more people. And this is the production of oils, the same. The largest producer is palm oil, soybean oil, rapeseed, and so on. At present, the choice of plant protein or oil that we use is based on a combination of local market availability and costs, the nutritional profile of the product, and its nutrition content. We believe that as the price of fish meal increases in the future, the use of plant protein concentrates will gain ground, especially for the higher trophic level species. And just For example, there have been estimates that the use of soybean protein concentrate within feed by 2020 will be at least 2.8 million tons. At the moment, the level is very small. Again, the important take-home message, this is the global production of cereals. This is the global production of oilseeds. This is the global production of meat. Again, the sectors are growing, and the byproducts that come from this are growing. But also, the competition is also growing. And I just give the example here of the use of genetically modified crops and products. Basically, the U.S. has been using this for the last 10 years, even though maybe the consumer does not know it. So this was in terms of ingredient usage. Another major area that we found was ingredient competition with other users. And that is that aquaculture, like any other animal production system, has to compete with other users for those ingredients. And so if I can just list the three or four major competitors, the first is competition with livestock. You know, we've got 708 million tons of animal feed produced. Aquaculture is only 29. But we're all using the same ingredients and we're all competing. And this just shows you that the share of global production of animal feed, aquaculture, is still... Again, these are compound feeds. It's still quite small compared to the production of poultry feeds, of pig feeds, and ruminant feeds. Okay? And if you look at countries like China, again, we all know China is the largest producer of aquaculture products. But if you look at feed production in China, aquaculture only represents about 13 million tons. One of the largest users of fish meal in China is the production of pig diets. Again, because production is so big and the country is so hungry. So you have this in-country competition within countries and also between countries. Also, we have another sector that's emerged, and that is competition with the pet food. We have a sector that's worth about $60 billion just for the production of cats and dogs. We estimate the value of the industry is about $49 billion. And these are, at the moment, one of the largest consumers of the animal byproducts from the rendering industry, and also of products that are coming from the production of salmon, like salmon meal and offal meals. And again, this is in China, but again, it's a very big and fast-growing sector. And if the sector will pay more for it, the product tends to go there rather than to other people. And this just really shows you the size of the pet food industry. Again, it's very big, it's growing quite fast, and very lucrative. Another area is competition with biofuels, and that is the potential problem of diverting existing food grains and crops from direct human consumption to more profitable biofuel production as a greener petroleum substitute. This basically leads to less grains and crops being available for direct human consumption and increased demand for these products, and so prices tend to increase. On the positive side, the biofuels industry also generates products that may be quite interesting. This is just one example. Within the U.S., you have production of about between 25 and 30 million tons of byproducts that come from corn, from the refinery. And these are products like distillers, grains and solubles and corn gluten meals. And then lastly, we have competition with humans. And that is competition between the use of fish for aquafeeds and the use of the same resources as food for humans. And this is particularly so for low-value fish species, and we estimate, again, if you remember, that China alone uses China reports the use of between 6 to 8 million tons of these products for its sector. And also we have the potential use of these food-grade forage fish for producing fish meal and fish oil. And so what you have is that you have certain aquaculture sectors that, yes, is very much dependent on the use of these fish species or the use of anchoveta to making fish meal, but also many of these fish species are consumed by the rural poor. And so when you take this out of the marketplace, then you have a food security issue. And this is just one example in Mexico of producing tuna, a very profitable industry, but basically using pelagics, sardines, to feed a product. In terms of economic terms, very good. The long-term sustainability is a problem because now the fish meal factories and the availability of these products in the marketplace is gone. But the use of these products is mainly for the higher value trophic level species, mainly intended for export. And at the moment, the major users are marine fishes, species like pangasius, lobsters, and some amphibians. Another major issue found by the report is the continued and growing importance of feed and food safety. And these are food safety risks associated with the use of contaminated feeds, either from the ingredients used or from external contamination of the feed due to poor storage. And these include things like salmonella, mycotoxins, drug residues, persistent organic pollutants, chemicals, heavy metals. But this is a problem not just for aquaculture, it's a problem for all animal feed production. And apart from the negative, potential negative effect of these contaminants on the health of the target species, there is also a potential risk to humans consuming these products. And in recent years, public concern concerning food safety has increased as a consequence of finding antibiotic residues in certain products and pollutants. And so coming now to the major recommendations of the study, the first major recommendation, again, these are recommendations related to ingredient selection and use. The first one is reduce country dependence upon imported feed ingredient sources. Again, these are the results from our survey. You have countries, and it's apparent that many aquaculture producing countries are highly dependent upon imports for sourcing their feed ingredient sources. And so we rank the countries, these are countries that more or less 25% of the ingredients they use in their feeds are imported. Countries like Argentina, Brazil, the USA, again, countries like Brazil, the US, they have all the ingredients in their hands. So the US happens to be the largest animal feed producer in the world. The reason being they have the ingredients also that can grow. You have other countries that report 25 to 50% of their ingredients are imported. This includes Australia, Canada, Denmark, India. Again, if you're producing feed for cattle and rojo, we can use local resources. If you're producing shrimp feeds, we have to import. And countries like Mexico, again, 20 to 40%. Other countries whose levels are between 50 to 75% of all their ingredients are being imported are Chile, China, Ecuador, Egypt, France, Italy, Turkey, the UK, Vietnam. And countries where between 75 and 100% of the ingredients are imported are listed here. When I work in Indonesia, 95% of all the ingredients are imported. Today it's okay, but what's going to happen about tomorrow? What's going to happen with energy prices and things like this? And so feed ingredient availability and usage within most developing countries at the moment is currently biased towards energy-rich rather than protein-rich ingredient sources, with greatest usage of local non-imported ingredients being within feeds for freshwater and brackish water fish feeds, targeted for domestic consumption or within farm-made feeds. So they cover an important niche. And there's promotion by some governments. If you look at countries like Malaysia, the government is actively trying to promote the local use of ingredients like copra, like rice, like palm cakes, the materials that we have available in our marketplace. Again, to make the industry more competitive. The other major finding is that we have to select ingredients that can sustainably be produced and can grow with the sector. Included in this, we included basically all the different products I've listed, like fishery and aquaculture byproduct meals and oils, invertebrate fishery byproduct meals and oils, terrestrial animal byproduct meals and fats, cereal byproducts, oilseed meals and oils, pulses. You know, at the end of the day, we need all of them. But in each country, it's going to be different. In each country, it's going to be different depending on availability and what we're culturing. But the most important thing is that we have to try and select ingredients that are growing and that can keep the industry growing. We also, the other major finding is the need to minimize the environmental and ecosystem impact of feeds and feeding regimes. One of the major criteria for ingredient selection is nutrient density and nutrient digestibility. It follows, therefore, that the higher the nutrient digestibility of a particular ingredient or feed, the higher its nutritional utilization and the faster the growth of the species. And at the same time, our environmental impact will be a lot less. Okay? And in addition to the use of these highly digestible feed ingredient sources and impacts, we can also change the way we produce our product. If we have a closed system, then those nutrients stay within the farm. And so what you have, and you heard this earlier this morning, are the development of what we call closed flock-based zero water exchange systems, whether it's to produce shrimp or whether it's to produce other species. Again, there are many different types of systems. But also you have other farms, like this is in Ecuador, where all the water is completely recirculated on the farm. It's a different type of recirculation system. But what they do is it's a system mainly to produce shrimp, but at the same time they're also producing tilapia in cages within the ponds. But these are systems where basically we have little or no environmental impact. And then also you have the zero exchange flock-based systems. This is where I've been working in Mexico, where basically you're culturing an animal and you never ever change the water. You just aerate it. And within that you produce a flock and you essentially change your animal from a monogastric animal where you have to use imported ingredients to like an aerobic ruminant, where now I can start reducing feed costs, I can start using local available waste streams. The problem with the system, we need aeration. But what we have is these are all systems that produce flock, bacterial, microbial proteins within the system. But you need an animal that can utilize it, like filter feeding species like tilapia and shrimp. I have 3 slides left, I'm sorry. The other main finding of the report is the need to give special attention to small-scale farmers using farm-made feeds. It is widely recognized that small-scale farmers still form the backbone of Asian aquaculture, and in production, and in particular for the production of freshwater fish species for domestic consumption. One of the hallmarks and characteristics of this sector is the use of farm-made feeds. However, apart from the lack of really good statistical information on how much is produced and where, there's actually little guidance given to farmers concerning the management and the production of these feeds to help formulate and make better feeds. To a large extent, this has been due to the push by government agencies and feed manufacturers to move away from the use of farm-made feeds to the use of more commercial formulated feeds. And again, if you look at the example of China, China is the largest producer of pigs in the world, but most of the pig is still small-scale. It's still based on farm-made feeds. So despite the relative merits and demerits of using farm-made aquafeeds, there is an urgent need to better assist the generally resource-poor farmers by using farm-made aquafeeds, not only by improving feed formulation, minimizing the use of unnecessary additives and chemicals, but also improving on-farm feed management and thereby reducing feed wastage and potential negative impacts. Last week, we had a meeting in Manila in the Philippines just on the use of farm-made feeds and the management of these feeds. Again, it's an important aspect. Okay, and so with that, I have my last slide, and I would really like to acknowledge those panel members that really actively contributed to produce this paper, and without whom this paper would not be as it is now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Albert, for your very informative overview on the fish nutrition, and to show up the opportunity and challenges to provide a high-quality feed for aquaculture and getting out from the fish meal trap. We are now invite the panelists of the expert panel number 3, namely Alan, Geoff Alan, Fatah El-Fayed, Mohammad Hassan, Andrew Jackson, Kaushik, Sergio Nates, Nguyen Tan Phong, Victor Suarez, to kindly come up to on the podium. Yes, please. Identify yourself. Yes, now.
Okay, now it's working. Yep, Jay Parsons from Canada. One of the comments somebody made earlier today, I think, was related to the supply of alternate protein and oil sources, and I wonder if you could comment on that, just as we switch over to these alternate sources, what will be the availability? Will it be lined up with our needs for these alternate sources, or will that represent a challenge?
Yes, I do believe. Yes, Bernardus. Please, panelists.
Yeah. No, again, the industry has been doing this for a long time. You know, again, when I showed you how the levels of fish meal and fish oil have been decreasing in the feeds, this has been the result of the sector trying to find to use these alternative protein and lipid sources. Again, the main sources at the moment are from the production of plant oil seeds. And depending on the country and depending on the market where you're selling your product, there are also lots of animal byproducts available. At the end of the day, the message is as in human nutrition, you know, we require 40 nutrients, but in each country, the way we supply it, that depends on the money and ingredients available in the marketplace. In terms of global feed, producing industrial feeds, to make a feed for a day, it's very easy. To do it 365 days a year is not so easy. So that's why the industry has always used so much fish meal, because it was available, it was cheap. But as the prices have been going up, the industry has learned to be less dependent on it and find other sources.
Thank you. Anybody would like to add on that?
I think just to add to that, I think if you look at 30 years ago, the poultry industry was using the great majority of available fish meal. And if someone at that stage said, in the future you'll get down to using 5% of fish meal will still be used in other sources, they'd have seen that as a huge challenge. And they addressed that by understanding the nutritional requirements and a few other sort of techniques like use of crystalline amino acids. But we're really in the same position with fish. So I think just I want to endorse what Albert's been saying, that our goal with aquaculture feeds is the same as the goal is with terrestrial feeds, understanding nutrient requirements and using a suite of ingredients available to meet those requirements.
I just can add also a few points that also the prices of the feed can change dramatically between through the supply chain from the producers to the farmer. In sub-Saharan Africa, for example, the price has increased by about 150% from the factory to the farmer. So this has been also to be controlled somehow by the governments or the farmers' associations.
Thank you. May I invite Sena? And after that, the gentleman with the blue shirt.
Sena from NACA. I think we aquaculture seems to be working within a black box. We pat ourselves on the back saying we have reduced the fish meal content in the feeds, this and that. But the fact is, from the public perception viewpoint, that we are the biggest fish meal users, right? We use the most amount of fish as raw material to make fish and so forth. So, and this is ultimately it's a dwindling resource, as Albert said. And this dwindling resource is being used, has many other uses. Pet food, mink coat industry, to name a few. And what we need is some sort of dialogue between these all these users so that we have a holistic approach to the use of this dwindling resource. So therefore, I rarely read my notes, but I'll read this time. I wonder whether this panel is in agreement that there is a need for a serious dialogue, and if so, the panel and this group is able to make a recommendation as a plan of action arising from this conference to the plenary so that the conference could adopt it. Thank you.
Mr. Panelist?
Yeah, but your point is correct. As Jeff was just telling, 30 years back, of course, there was quite a bit of fish meal which was being used for other purposes, and quite a bit of fish oil was used for very strange things, for industrial purposes, even for some motors. And these are things which are happening. And the kind of fish meal that was there 30 years back is not the same which is found today in the industry. There is also big, significant progress made in terms of quality of fish meals. This is where we got to think about it. Aquaculture uses what you call the prime quality fish meals generally. And, of course, there are various grades of fish meal. This is where we lack precise statistical information. Having said that, we have seen all through the years that for the past 30 years or so, the reduction fisheries or whatever we call them now. We have some euphemisms every other day. And we have the same amount of fish meal and fish oil which is being produced. The cost of ingredients is one thing. And it's the global availability of this ingredient which is not going to increase. And there is also a tendency to go, because of the sustainability issues, of getting them directly to the human consumption. So these are issues which make it necessary that we got to look for alternatives if we want to continue to maintain the aquaculture development as it is today or as we expect that projections will be. So this is a point that you say, yes, but there is a limit. We know for ourselves it's not more than 5 million tons of fish meal and 1 million ton of fish oil. And this is not going to change until something else is coming in. Even then, with all the projections that we have about all of the marine sources, it's not going to happen. So we've got to make best use of these ingredients and make the best use in the sense that we've got to provide through aquaculture for the human consumption without taking much more pressure on the fisheries. We should be able to come up with something with the pocket consensus on that, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, the gentleman with blue. Yes, you are.
It's a long walk, but it's worth it. David Liddell from University of Stirling. I was intrigued by the panel's insistence that there's still a place for on-farm made feeds. And I wonder if this is a moment for reflection, given the last 10 years, how much progress has been made, that's the first thing, given the other trends happening in the industry. And whether the panel or anyone else thinks that perhaps people need to sit back and think, well, what is really happening? We have giant feed manufacturing corporations moving into all the big aquaculture clusters of the world. And here we are, 2010, saying farmers can make their own feeds and compete, knowing full well that although there are smaller-scale operations, just like smaller-scale pig operations, making pig feeds is very different from making good-quality fish feeds. We've got to think about water stability, the cost of the equipment, the know-how, all of these factors. And I'm wondering what the panel think about perhaps a revised focus towards smaller, medium-sized enterprises, more at a local level, where there may be some hope through using local feed ingredients as a majority of what's going into the feed, that they stand a competitive chance in that context, the emerging context we see around the world. Thanks.
Thank you. May I invite the panelists to respond to that? Actually, we have more microphones here.
What you say is this is what we discussed upon a week back in Manila, for instance, in terms of how to... thing is, we do not have yet, as Albert mentioned, exact proportions of what you call this farm-made feeds. Compared to what is called industry feeds, statistics is much easier to obtain. Nevertheless, one of the major objectives is, again, even this farm-made feed should be made in a way that is nutritionally balanced if it is a complete feed. I here join very much with what Sena was saying, is very often, if you are using as a complementary feed or supplementary feed along with the natural productivity, there we lack not a lot of knowledge in the same what kind of nutrients that we should supply in this compound feed. Yes, your point is right. We should try to promote regional, local, small-scale feed manufacturing industries. That is for the local governments to do that, to support such industries. There is sufficient knowledge available today that they can be easily applied. And this is one of the things that can happen without having to rely totally only upon big companies or big groups of mergers and amalgamations which have been occurring in other industries. It's applicable to what has happened in the poultry industry, for instance. So this is something which we have to think about. It. Your point is right.
Just to add one point. I think one of the concepts is on-farm. When you talk on-farm, that is no longer valid. We say farm-made feed. That not necessarily the farm-made feed does mean to that it's produced in farm. We are also trying to include that is the farm feed which is produced by small-scale feed manufacturers, locally based, using locally feed ingredients, medium scale, So we are not really trying to say that when you were talking of farm-made feed, which of course the data is unavailable, we are all talking about the formulated feed, the compound feed, which is produced commercial feed manufacturers. But we are also including that feed manufacturers which are locally based and assistance which you need to provide in terms of the improvement of quality. Of course, that is one of the concepts which we want to go ahead. And that was one of the primary focus in our Manila workshop, which we're trying to sort of address the issues of feed which is produced locally, local industries, which is maybe small or medium scale. Thank you very much.
Yes, Albert.
Hello. I just wanted to add what everybody had said and what Dave said about farm-made feeds. Again, there's a whole range of different processes and scales of farm-made feeds, and you have lots of companies now supplying equipment to make feeds not, you know, at the low end, but also at higher levels. For example, in Mexico, where I'm working, we have 3,000 hectares of shrimp, but all that feed is made under our definition of farm-made. We don't buy it commercially, but we give the formulation and we get someone to make it for us. But there's a transition from the throwing in the rice bran or producing the cattle or the rohu in India to the other level. I just think that we have to, you know, be able to address all different sectors. Obviously, the commercial sector has its own view and how it wants it, but I take your point. But at the end of the day, as ingredient prices go up and as the cost of our commodities stay static or go down, you know, you're going to get a lot of people, and including the company that I was working with in Mexico, instead of buying commercial feed, making it themselves under contract, we get rid of all the overheads. And it's a type of farm-made feed, but it's in between the full-on commercial one, so to speak.
Thank you.
Can I just add one comment? There's many countries where the cost of commercial feeds is just prohibitively expensive because of transport costs, because of too small a market, and that occurs through the Pacific and many countries in Africa, for example. And so many of those countries, the use of farm-made feeds or small-scale feeds, I think is very important. So I'd really endorse your sentiments, David, and say that a focus on better formulations using locally available materials that are species and site-specific is an important solution to some parts of the agriculture growth.
Thank you. I saw the gentleman back there. No. Yes, here.
Good afternoon. Courtney Huff from FIAP and the European Aquaculture Technology and Innovation Platform. We're very aware in Europe of criticism on the amount of fish that is used to produce fish, particularly the carnivorous ones. So in reference to the ubiquitous fish-in, fish-out ratio, do you believe that this is actually a valid measure that could be put forward? Because this is the one that is being used as extensive criticism of the aquaculture sector. So that's referring fish-in, fish-out ratio. Is it a valid measurement?
Yes. Is it really only European? The question is not just European. It's very often comes from eastern part of the United States. That's a different story. having said that, yes, the thing is, when we talk about fish-in, fish-out, this is... many people know that I have made some comments on this issue recently. And there are two things, because we can also talk about trash fish in, good fish out. You know, we can talk about that way. This is what is happening in majority of places here, for instance. So having said that, again, we've got to remember that we have only 5 million tons of fish meal and 1 million ton of fish oil. So in any feed in which this proportion of 5 to 1 is changing, it is the fish oil which is going to govern this fish-in, fish-out ratio. So this is something which we've got to admit. And secondly, is there a normal measure? If I was talking as a protein metabolism or amino acid, I can use other yardstick saying that fish protein in, fish protein out. And this is one way of tackling the issue. Or many people, especially the majority of the NGOs, talk about is the whole fish coming in, whole fish going out. If we take it, there is a definite issue of using the fish meal for production, and this is where I said the best utilization of available resources is we've got to, whether we have to use this same fish in, fish out ratio I even tried to joke saying this, why not plant sin, piss us out? In the sense that we have, that is what is really happening if you take the whole aquaculture industry as such. There is more protein. This is exactly what is happening in human nutrition. 40% or more than that, all over the world, irrespective of the continent or the country, our protein intake is 40% comes from, at least 40% or per unit kilogram is coming from plants. Then we are talking about animal protein and in which seafood protein which is coming up. So we got to think about it. This is a competitive issue in terms of resource allocation. If we want, we are going to compete with other industries. And this is where we got to show our efficiency in demonstrating that fish is more efficient than other terrestrial production systems. This is where our challenge, and we have much advantages over this.
Thank you. Still in front of you?
No, just to add what Sachi said. I mean, the bottom line for all of us is that we have a finite resource, and although we would like to use more of it, there just really isn't. In the calculation of the paper that a lot of the NGOs cite from mine on my fish in, fish out ratio, those values are based on conversion factors developed by the Chilean salmon industry. They weren't my values. If you go to the paper and you look on how we calculated it, it's from the industry itself. But obviously the issue is that for certain sectors, and obviously the NGOs have gone on this bandwagon, is that we have some sectors that consume much more fish than they produce. And obviously, you know, we have to somehow try and move away from these systems, again, mainly because of the limited resources that we have. But again, you have there's a brand new paper that recently came out by Davis on bycatch. There's estimates now of bycatch of 38.5 million tons of potential product that we might be able to process.
Thank you. We have a very good discussion, but time limited. I will allow just only two more. The one is the gentleman with white shirt, and the last one is yours. Yes, please.
When Sana's talking about ingredient availability and reaching consensus and recommendations that we should make coming out of this type of a meeting, I wonder if it makes sense for us to say that the industry should be using this ingredient or the industry should be using that ingredient, because at the end of the day, most of that's going to be driven by price and availability. That what we really need to do is to understand better what the nutrient requirements are and what the nutrient values are of different ingredients, particularly local ingredients, anti-nutritional factors, things like that, so that feed manufacturers can make informed decisions when they do their formulation rather than working on an ingredient basis.
Panelists accepted the comment. Yes, please. Last one, please.
Max Torell from the Bayer Institute, Stockholm. In your paper, you make some prognosis for the future. And if you do an analysis of like 10, 15 years back, you can find these kind of prognosis as well. And it seems to me that they have been very wrong. And I wonder, why have they been so wrong in estimating the future use of fish meal and fish oil in aquaculture? And what kind of surprises can we expect for your future prognosis from today?
Yeah, I'm not convinced that all the prognosis that have been made have been wrong. I think probably the growth has been faster than some of those expectations for 10 years ago. But in terms of the use of fish meal and fish oil, I think the projections were that was going to increase. It's probably increased faster. But you know, I think in the end we've come back to that same issue. Fish meal, fish oil, we've got limited availability. Some sources will go up through extra processing wastes, but there's only 5 million tonnes. But I think that we've got a suite of other ingredients, as Albert's described, that the aquafeed sector will compete with other uses for those ingredients. And where they can compete, once the market allows us, we'll use those ingredients. And where they can't compete, there'll be some industries that will decline.
Response to Max, yes. I can say yes, there were some issues which were totally not connected with aquaculture. The bovine spongiform encephalopathy, TSSE, that led at least in a big chunk of the continent, European continent for instance, not allowing any animal product into animal feed, fish it being considered as an animal, and there was, at the time, there was even discussion not allowing fish meal into fish. I had to go and discuss about this change. So that means the poultry industry and pre-ruminant calves or pig industry who were using fish meal, they could not use anymore. They had to rely on other sources, and there was more fish meal available for aquaculture. That is also another point that we got to take into account, and you can see that this was one of the reasons, for instance, we were relying very much on the fish meal and fish oil industry because that was not being used by the terrestrial animal industry. Yes, your point is right in certain points that there were some projections which are made without taking into account what you call the crisis situations which changed to a certain extent. You're right.
Thank you. An anecdote from that Dr. Kashi just said, the first case of BSC happens in the United States, the price of meat and bone meal dropped down to about $70 per metric ton. Every single feed manufacturer in the U.S. switched to use meat and bone meal. It took less than 4 weeks to go back to $200. So, you know, it's going to be the biggest issue in ingredient availability, I think, is going to be the return on investment. Which one of these industries we're competing with has more money, power, you know, economical power to buy ingredients? That's what's going to pretty much trigger what is going to be available to us.
The other thing I wanted to add is that the levels in the papers that we presented are levels given or are levels based on the responses by commercial feed companies in different parts of the world and the levels that they use. And another thing that's going to happen in the future, if you remember I said that the largest source of animal protein available in the marketplace are the byproducts from the rendering industry, 13 million tons, and 10 of fat. This is coming from farm shrimp, from farm animals. As aquaculture is growing now, we also have a sector where we're going to get a new type of fish meal and a new type of fish oil that comes from pangasius, or it comes from salmon, or it comes from shrimp head. You know, again, when I said 13 and 10 million tons, that comes from the aquaculture equivalent in agriculture. And aquaculture, so we're going to get these products coming in. If the people here was from the International Fish Meal and Fish Oil Organization, they estimate now that at least 25% of the fish meal is produced from byproducts. So these are new things that are going to come on stream. But at the end of the day, the feed manufacturer formulates their feeds based on the target species, the cost of that, and the cost of ingredients. And that's why fish meal levels have gone down. Mainly it's been an economic driver.
Thank you very much. I have the signal for the organizer that it has to be finished by now because the next session is the plenary. We have to open this partition very soon. So, but we are still on the mood because the next presentation is also related to fish nutrition and fish feed. So may I invite distinguished delegates to give a big hand to our hardworking panelists. Thank you very much. You have done a very good job. Thank you very much. Congratulations. Thank you.